Your starter for 10 this morning, David, why are you no longer the government's independent chief inspector of borders and immigration?
Well, sadly, I was dismissed a couple of weeks ago after the Home Secretary lost confidence in me.
And have you got it clear in your mind why?
I'm clear that I did everything I thought I should do as the independent chief inspector in accordance with the law. I scrutinised the Home Office's functions when I couldn't communicate appropriately with ministers because they didn't want to see me. Then I chose to speak to the papers in order to bring this to people's attention. And what I was bringing to the attention of the public was significant security risks at the border.
This is the only broadcast interview that you're giving, David. Why are you speaking out now?
Well, I always intended, I'd agreed to do this as the broadcast interview when I left the job. So I think it's entirely appropriate when you say you're going to do something to honour it. I've been asked by everyone to speak and I've not spoken apart from this. I've got no axe to grind, but I do feel it's important that, you know, I get the opportunity to speak. You said when we were on Universal Challenge, you know, why had I not spoken, you know, on the Today programme?
Well, I asked you for the scoop. I knew you were a man in power and I knew that migration policy at the moment is not working as the government would like it to. And you're someone who could explain this. We'll go on to discuss why. So, I wanted the scoop for the Today
programme. No, absolutely. And I made a conscious effort not to speak in the media. The issue is so polarised that actually what I've sought to do is remain inside the tent and shape as best I can using our reports. You know, I'm an inspector. I'm not a regulator. So the only power that I've got is soft power, is the power of communication. Now, I could choose to do that on the Today programme. The way that I've chosen to do it is through our reports and through, you know, written media.
And just to explain how that works, you choose a part of our borders, a part of that border security, part of the immigration system, and say, let's go and have a look at that. Let's study it. And then the idea is to write a report, not for me or a mole, but for a minister, to say, look at how this is working, or more importantly, not working.
Absolutely, Nick, and that's critical, and that's in the Borders Act, directly in the legislation. So I've got free rein over all of the system. We go out on the ground once we've selected what it is that we want to inspect. We go out on the ground, and then we write the findings up. The audience for my reports is the Home Secretary. It's not for civil servants. The legislation's quite clear. I write to the Secretary of State.
Let's go through some of those reports that have now been published after you let go. Suddenly, a great tranche of these reports that hadn't been published were suddenly published. One that caught the eye was about the security at our borders, in particular e-passports. Now, those reports involve you going, does it?
It does,
going,
yeah.
And looking.
It does. And so we inspected, I suppose, one of the unique ways that I've approached this job, or perhaps different to other inspectors perhaps, is that I've been personally involved in the vast majority of the inspections. So when it came to e-passport gates, you know, I was there at Heathrow Airport with the team and I saw many of the things that were reported on myself.
What did you see?
Well, we saw the Border Force officers, for example, you know, who aren't equipped with communication devices, not equipped with radios. So we're in this ridiculous position where the front line of defence at the 8th busiest airport in the world, the attention of officers who are working there is attracted to their colleagues by, you know, whistling or waving or, you know, which is absolute madness. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, the public want to hear that. And I'm pretty sure that the public would think that's appalling. Everyone seems to have a radio this day and age.
And just to be clear, to what extent do you think that those failures in e-passports are compromising the security of this country and our borders?
The inspection that's just been published was actually a follow-up inspection to a much lengthier e-passport gates inspection that took place at the end of COVID. So we wanted to go back, and specifically we wanted to look back at the role of roving officers, which is that when there are more than 10 passport gates in operation, as there are at Heathrow, there needs to be at least 2 roving officers. So therefore, that's the officer who is forward of the e-gates, who's looking at the behaviour, who's mitigating the risk of the technological, you know, the increase in technology to make people flow through the border faster. And we didn't find that was taking place. So actually, this inspection discovered that nowhere were the 2 roving officers. So I think that's really worrying strategically for the Home Office, because what that means is, as we move forward to, you know, quicker borders, move forward to more technology, actually the human mitigations are not in place. And that's what the report's trying to get into.
And e-passport gates and border security at airports is just one bit of what you were looking at as an inspector. Tell us what you found at a place called Manston. Tell us what Manston is and what you saw there.
These are migrants, asylum seekers who've come through the small boat system. So what it is, effectively, you'll recall that we had, there was Tug Haven, which was a jumble of tents on the quayside at Dover. Then there was a site called Western Jetfoil, which effectively triages and prioritises individuals who are coming off the boats. And then they move to Manston, and Manston gives more space for the authorities to properly check the security status of individuals, to do very rough, you know, medical inspections.
Very mindful of the legal obligations you're speaking under and restrictions you're speaking under, but for most people listening to this now, they have no idea what these centres are like. So can you give us the detail that you can about what are the conditions in these places? We're talking about places often located relatively near the border, just for practical reasons, where migrants, some of whom will be granted asylum and some of whom won't, are kept while their asylum claims are being processed. This is a subject that arouses huge interest because it's expensive to keep them there, and if you can't keep them there, they have to move to hotels, which we might come on to. But what are the sorts of conditions you're talking about?
Well, we're talking about the number of the capacity of the reasonable capacity of the site had been overwhelmed, and what we'd seen was a sort of a creeping lack of ambition on the part of the Home Office to build proper facilities. So what we had was temporary facilities, was tented buildings whereby asylum seekers, you know, sometimes, you know, several hundred were inside single tents, effectively, you know, heated tents, but nevertheless they were sleeping on kit mats or roll-up mats on the floor with blankets. They were sleeping, you know, next to each other. You know, this was like a sort of, you know, the refugee, you know, situation that you see overseas.
Often very traumatised people that have been on a very hazardous journey, to put it mildly.
Absolutely, and you've got children, you've got families there, you've got grown-ups there who've, you know, many of them are still in the clothes that they've worn when they've come across in the inflatables. You know, so it's a pretty grim place. And what wasn't happening was they were not moving on into hotels within the system. So the idea would be that there'd be a free flow of people coming through, that people would be there for no more than 24 hours. So in effect, it's a police holding cell, in effect.
Did you conclude that this might be deliberate? You know, there'll be some people listening to this who are moved by the plight of these people. There'll be other people listening who say, it needs to be grim. You know, if we want to persuade people not to get on a small boat and come across the channel, they need to get the message that if you do, it's not all of the camp.
And Nick, we hear that, I hear that all of the time. And we hear that in relation to the barge, for example. You know, is this the reason that they've done it? And cock-up or conspiracy, question mark, it's always cock-up. I'd be the first to seek out a conspiracy if I saw one. And I don't think this is a conspiracy. I think this is just poor Home Office activity. I think it's just poor flow management, in effect.
And even if you're concerned about security, which you obviously are, I think you're saying you can equally be concerned about humanity. They're not in competition.
They are absolutely not in competition. My background, working in for a number of years in Afghanistan and assuring UK detention facilities in Afghanistan, where, you know, hundreds of suspects, you know, had been taken into detention, many of those suspects subsequently convicted of killing British soldiers and NATO personnel. We never had a plan to be beastly to those people. We dealt with them in as transparent a way as we possibly could, and as well as we possibly could, to really high standards.
Do you think the conditions were worse in Manston than they often were in Afghanistan when you were having to detain people who were terrorist suspects?
I think that would be fair to say, and even to the degree when I saw children housed in at the children's holding facility called the Kent Intake Unit down at Dover Docks, and I'd written to the Home Secretary. I was that appalled by the conditions that I saw. I'd written to the Home Secretary to say that these were worse than the conditions that I saw in Afghanistan. And I think that's one of the frustrations that I've had, is that I've not had access to ministers as quickly as I should have done in order to bring that sort of thing to their attention.
I really want to talk about the function or dysfunction of the Home Office in a second. But what you're talking about with Manston, as you say, it's effectively a police holding cell as part of a system, a through flow to hotels. And this is a subject that we cover quite a lot on the Today programme. It's often written about in the press, and most people don't understand. Can you just give us, before we get into the specifics of the inspections, a broad sense of how many asylum seekers are currently in hotels at great cost to the taxpayer, and whether or not that's the best place for them to be?
It's tens of thousands of people who are in hotels right around the country. And the conditions that they're in vary dramatically, often with inappropriate food, culturally insensitive food. Now, going back to your point, Nick, you know, some people would say, well, at least you're feeding them. Well, actually, it's got to be better than that. You can't have children who can't eat, you know, food, who are losing weight because of the consequences of that. So actually, we need to do much better than that.
And what about the calibre of the inspections done on those hotels?
The assurance from the Home Office is very light. And if it was a lot more stringent, then clearly they'd be detecting the sort of thing that I or my team as a statutory inspection body wouldn't need to be detecting.
When you say light, do you mean they don't go?
They don't. Well, they're not resourced as deeply as they should be to hold contractors to account. The model, the Home Office.
How do they check things out then?
It's often self-assurance. Yeah. So, for example, in the Children in Hotels inspection that's recently been published, you're self-assuring. So you're asking the contractor, you know, have you got DBS checks, which is just bread and butter sort of stuff. This is not.
So you're reliant, sorry to interrupt, but you're reliant on either a chat with them or what, a Zoom call or something like that, just to check?
Correct. You know, when actually, do you know what you have to do? In all my experience in the military, you have to check, check and check again. We used to have a phrase in the military, trust the soldiers with your life, but nothing else.
Now, in the report that has been published about hotels, you said, quote, this points to a lack of grip and poor leadership. From whom?
Well, I think from officials within the Home Office. Ministers are accountable for these decisions, of course they are. But I've seen again and again in so many areas, senior officials who, you know, just don't get it. The Home Office just didn't really have a handle on how to hold to account, how to make sure there's value for money, and how to make sure the sort of things we just discussed in terms of humanity. Good food, you know, decent religious observance, you know, clean toilets, provision of all of the basic things that we would have looked at for prisoners in Afghanistan, you know, often are not understood by the people who are delivering it. It's delivered in an academic type of way. And it comes down to this challenge in the Home Office of policy people versus operational people. And this doesn't cost a lot, Nick. We're not talking about sort of super postgrads here. We're talking about normal people who have experience of delivery of functions.
And how senior do the problems go? I mean, how senior are the officials that you think don't show the necessary grip?
It goes right to the top, surely. If you're going to be responsible for a department, if you're going to lead, accountable for the outputs of your department, then clearly it goes right up to the Permanent Secretary.
What is it about the Home Office, how it's run, how it's led, that causes so much to go so wrong so often?
Well, you know, the Home Office is a massive department and it's a complex department. You know, I've not got a view over all of it. I'm just, you know, monitoring, you know, very small parts of what it delivers. I think that the Home Office is often embattled. And so therefore people lose the self-confidence, perhaps. People lose that desire to engage with others who might have contrary views, for example. So they're not necessarily as forward-leaning as they could be. They struggle sometimes to communicate their intention. And I think there is a culture within the Home Office that means that they are sort of blaming up. You know, what do I mean by that? I mean blaming up to ministers. You know, there's a sort of sometimes rolls eyes expressions from senior people you encounter. Well, if it was only not for the beastly Home Secretary, if it was only not for the way that this government's going, which actually is not good enough. You can't get away with that in the army. You don't complain about the situation. You deal with the world as is, not as how you hope it to be.
Just to remind people, you're not a political figure. You're not making a political point, but you are saying, David, that officials sometimes go, well, you know, not our fault, their fault. We've come up with these daft ideas.
But I think not as explicitly as that, because I'm not a political person, but I have encountered on a number of times when the sort of lack of responsibility, accountability, authority, where that's absent. And I'll give you an example, Nick. The contingency asylum accommodation, so the barge, so the barracks, so the hotels at the moment, that's moved in the last 18 months across four senior leaders. Well, that's absolute madness in terms of accountability.
That's extraordinary. I had no idea. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, if you think about, you know, ministers are ultimately responsible for the delivery. But below that, who is the senior official who's running this? Who's going to be accountable for it and who's going to have a grip?
And running what exactly?
Running the whole, all of the hotels, all of the provision of asylum accommodation, so the strategy, that sits with one senior official at the Director General level. And until very recently, was at the Second Permanent Secretary level as well. So at a really high level. So if you as the interviewer are looking for someone to hold to be accountable, you want to know where to pin the rose.
This conversation that we've been having takes me back quite a long way when I was political editor and a man called John Reid became Home Secretary. The Home Secretary before him had to quit because of confusion over foreign prisoners. The immigration minister had to quit. There was a long line of people who had to quit. He had quite a pithy description of the Home Office. Do you remember that moment?
You know I did, Nick. I'm not going to repeat it either.
What, not to repeat the phrase?
Well, you're not going to draw me into repeating the phrase. I know that's what you're trying to do.
I'll say the phrase then. I mean, the phrase was not fit for purpose that John Reed used.
Yeah, and I think it would be unhelpful for me to be attached to that phrase. I think what I've got is what I'm very happy to say is that the Home Office, you know, is dysfunctional, that the Home Office needs reform. I think, you know, the Prime Minister, when he was, you know, running for leader of the party, one of his 10, one of the 10 points was fundamental reform of border force, fundamental reform of the Home Office. I do encounter, much to some people's surprise, I do encounter good practice and good stuff, but equally, I think it does need a brush for taking over it.
Would it be a terrible journalistic thing to say that if you say dysfunctional, lack of grip, poor leadership, a culture of defensiveness, a reluctance to engage, sacrificing quality for the speed of decisions, and you say it goes to the very top. I might summarise that, just let me suggest, as not fit for purpose.
Well, you said that, Nick, but not David, I can confirm.
I can possibly say that, Nick.
But I tell you, I can possibly comment. Yeah.
You mentioned the sort of culture of rolled eyes and blaming up and ministers. How much access did you get to ministers that you wanted to see? And more importantly, how much did you see of the Home Secretaries that you served under?
I think the previous two Home Secretaries, I think it's well logged that I was unable to see Priti Patel. And then I saw Suella Braverman twice. I got reasonably good access during the Patel regime to ministers. There used to be the two ministers, Foster and Philp, and then subsequently Purslow. So we got reasonable access there. And then with Minister Jenrick during the Braverman time, good access. It waned towards the end. And then with these ministers, having called for an urgent meeting over what I'd seen at City Airport, that meeting took a week to arrange, so that's not, in my book, particularly urgent, and then it was cancelled on the morning of when I was going to speak. So access has been really patchy, and I think it's really important, Amal, because actually my role should be to reach over the top of civil servants who are prepared to put a gloss on the news. It should be to reach into the ministers to be able to tell them what's going on. And that's the deal I've always said to them. Now, I think, paradoxically, I think with the current Home Secretary, I think there are some real positives. And I think, had I remained, I think I'd have been able to communicate with him a lot better.
You've a couple of times made clear that you think James Cleverly, the current Home Secretary, is someone you could do business with, but he did fire you.
No, no. And there you go. That's a terrible contradiction. But like, as I said,
what explains it?
Well, it explains the firing, or
yeah,
whether it was actually the Home Secretary who fired me, whether or not, bear in mind the Home Secretary, we've seen evidence, so we see disclosed material to suggest that the current crop of ministers and the Home Secretary actually wanted to reappoint me. So actually, I'd have been doing another 3 years in this job. So there'll be no scrutiny of small boats. There'll be no scrutiny of adults at risk in immigration detention, which is a controversial area. There will be no publishing of the Rwanda material, which was before the Supreme Court. In terms of next year's programme, unless there's a chief inspector appointed, and that won't be for some 6 to 9 months, there'll be no scrutiny of the future Rwanda material the decisions are being made on.
We must talk about it. Just before we do, to be clear, James Cleverly wanted to keep you in post and was overruled by Downing Street, who said he needs to go.
As I understand it, yes. I've seen evidence, I've seen disclosed material as part of the judicial review that says that ministers, having seen them in January, approved my reappointment. The Home Secretary approved my appointment. It went through the Cabinet Office, and then we went to Number 10, and it was Number 10 that turned it down. I can't tell you, I've not seen material as to who in Number 10 turned it down.
Now, to be fair to them, wouldn't they say, those people who didn't want you reappointed, that David Neil became frustrated because he didn't get meetings with ministers he wanted, and he didn't get his reports published, and he did eventually talk to a paper, and therefore he had to go.
No, I have to correct you, Nick. Yes, you would be right, apart from the fact that the material about the reappointment took place before the sacking. So there's two issues here. One is the non-reappointment, and then secondly is the sacking. Now, I think the question to ask is, why did Number 10 go over the top of the Home Office not to reappoint David Neil, who clearly the current Home Secretary and the ministers assumed was doing a really good job? Now, the subsequent sacking is something slightly different.
Yeah, so in other words, just to be clear to people, you did, out of frustration, get a report to a newspaper, but that was after that decision.
Correct.
Am I putting two and two together and making five? Because it seems to me you say, the Prime Minister didn't want to reappoint me. I don't know why, but it stopped me scrutinising his very controversial policy about Rwanda. I think I might have just worked out why.
Well, you go. I don't know, Nick. I work on evidence. I work on what I've seen, and I've not seen that. But that would be for someone like you to be able to make the connection.
Can I just ask you about Rwanda? Is your sense, based on what you've seen, is your view that the Rwanda policy can be made to work?
Without being too controversial, without going over my bounds of independence, yes. We can make anything work. You know, we're a wealthy country that's full of talented people. We can make anything work. And I think that's been some of the frustration of the failure of the Home Office to work.
And did you say that as things stand with your departure, there's no one who's actually going to be overseeing the scrutiny of the small boats policy? There's no one's going to be overseeing the scrutiny of the Rwanda plan. And if that is the case, what are the implications?
Well, it means that, you know, there's got to be a loss of public confidence that there isn't someone independent like me who's in position, who's up to sort of, you know, up to speed, who can choose to inspect what they choose to inspect, whether it's in the programme or outside of the programme, to give the public the assurance that that the government's doing its job properly. Now, I heard Minister Purslow speak earlier in the week, and he intimated that there could be an interim chief inspector brought in, and that might get over the immediate mechanics of the thing. But it took me a year to get up to speed. This is devilishly complex stuff, and if you've not got an absolute watertight case in your reports to the Home Office, you just get taken apart. So it needs to be really detailed work.
Just so I'm clear about the implications or possible implications, in terms of the welfare of people who come here, that means there will not be someone inspecting that.
There'll certainly not be someone independent who's inspecting that, and that's the key, Nick, because the Home Office will say that they've got assurance in place, that there are assurance regimes, but for someone independently to get out there, lift up stones, and then be able to communicate to the Home Secretary and Ministers what's going on the ground, that will be absent.
And the other side of the coin, the security of the country and making sure that these facilities don't allow people who shouldn't be here or perhaps in an isolated number of examples are dangerous to be here, that also will not be inspected.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right, the other side of the coin, because much of the debate is dominated by asylum. But actually, the border force, the protection of our borders, is a 24/7 activity that affects every single person in this country. And that's why it's so critical. You know, and I think that if I have a regret of my 3 years, I've not been able to do more scrutiny of security at the border.
Well, people listening to you will infer from what you say, David, that the dysfunction that you describe, the churn, the lack of grip, means that our streets are less safe than they ought to be.
Well, they're certainly not as effective as they should be. Sorry, I'm being mealy-mouthed there. They're certainly not as effective as they should be, because actually a really effective border force, you know, looking at some of the, you know, models overseas, for example, has an investigative element, as well as there's no investigative element within Border Force. So the intrusive sort of, you know, curious, aggressive almost with a small A, you know, getting after what's coming across the border is something that we really should be getting after. So if you were to ask me what I think reform should take place, education, training, you know, I've met people in the Border Force who've been there for 35 years and have never been on a proper course to train them in stuff. It's absolutely shocking. The public would expect there to be a proper force protecting the border. I'm not sure it's anywhere near as effective as it could be.
The practical consequences of that would be, A, well, at the very worst, you'd have potentially harmful people, criminal people, being in this country that you ought not to have in this country, or, which may not seem as bad to some people, but you don't know who's here and who isn't. You simply don't have good enough data about the people that are in this country, including whether or not they ought not to be in this country.
Absolutely, and we don't even do checks on people leaving the country, so we don't know. And ministers have been, you know, on a number of occasions before, have been held to account as to how many people are in the country, who's in the country, because we no longer check. I think it was the Blair government stopped exit checks taking place, so we don't know how much money is being taken out of the country, for example.
You're not looking at any notes. This is in your mind, isn't it? And if you'll forgive me pointing out, when you were talking at the beginning of this, you said, "We do this," describing a job you're no longer doing because you've been let go. In a sense, you've embodied this, haven't you? You care passionately
lived it.
About it.
Whenever the team prepare me to go in front of the Select Committee, they always criticise me for saying "we." And I've used the term "we" for my team when I should be using the term "I." I've used the term "we" for the Home Office, my team and myself, which clearly not on the same side, but I think we are, because the "we" is actually we protecting collectively the country. And I've got a role to play in that in terms of highlighting security failures. So there is a "we," and you know, I don't see this as an us and them. I see that as a collective effort.
What next for you, David? You're still a young man, you're very good at quizzes, and you talk with obvious passion for national security and public service. What's David Neil going to do next?
Well, I really hope that I'll be able to continue to contribute to public service. I think it's really important to do what I've done. I think that having the moral courage to speak truth to power is a rare thing in public life. I think it's a rare thing. Moral courage is often more difficult to have than physical courage. And I've, you know, I've paid the price. You know, no one wants to have sacked on their CV. But I think I've done the right thing. And I think, well, I know I've done the right thing. My conscience is absolutely clear. And I think as the report will be published into London City Airport, you know, my position undoubtedly will be vindicated. So what I hope to do, I hope I'll be able to contribute.
And to be clear, if Secretary were it to be Yvette Cooper called you up and said, David, I want you back, that's a conversation you'd be open to.
Absolutely. It's irrespective. If James Cleverly were to say, I tell you what, Dave, we've made a mistake, do you want to come back? I said yes. All of the stakeholders that we've dealt with, who right across the political spectrum, none of them would question the work that we've done in terms of independence or impartiality or doing the right thing on a bad day when no one's looking. And that's what you're buying. That's what you're buying from someone who's been in the army. It's a strong moral compass and doing the right thing. And I'm sure there must be a role in public life for someone like me to be able to do that sort of thing.
David Neil, former government independent chief inspector at Borders and Immigration. Thank you very much indeed.
David, it's really good to see you. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.